I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 176 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, and Andrew Frankel. This week we were supposed to be focusing on high performance estate cars, and we do come onto those a little bit later on, doing this now because Andrew has been driving the new Audi RS6 Performance. But we sort of got sidetracked a little bit by first Formula One and then the Munich Motor Show. So we do 10 or 15 minutes on F1 and Max Verstappen's extraordinary dominance this year, and then some of the highlights from the Munich Motor Show. There's some interesting stuff that's been revealed over the last few days. And then we do get onto performance estate cars. I hope you enjoy the episode. Thank you for listening. And remember, please, to rate and review the podcast wherever you listen to it. And also just hit the follow button or the subscribe button. It means you don't miss a single episode. And it also helps us out enormously as well. So please do that. Enjoy the episode. Thank you for listening. 10 Grand Prix wins in a row for Max Verstappen. That means he beats Sebastian Vettel's record of 9 wins in a row. Bloody hell, that is some achievement, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I was a bit put out by Lewis saying what he did about, oh, well, you know, it's kind of easy for him because he's never had any difficult, you know, any tough teammates.
Yeah.
You know, Sainz was one of his teammates. Yeah, yep. Danny Ric, back in the day when Danny Ric was one of his teammates. Okay, but Max hasn't been in the business as long as Lewis has. And yeah, I think Lewis has had like three world champions as teammates. But I just thought, fair play to Max. He's got the best car. He's much better than his teammate. So he wins all the races. But yeah, I just thought it was like inelegant. And smacked of sour grapes, and you know Lewis not wanting his record. No, it wasn't Lewis's record to begin with, was it? It was Seb's. But
no.
I just didn't think it was particularly becoming to go and have a little bit of a pop like that. Yeah, 10 Grand Prix straight is extraordinary, because that means you have won on every single type of circuit in every single kind of condition. And I guess that what must be really worrying is a man appears at the moment. He appears like Lewis was. Do you remember when Lewis went through that season? Must have been about 4 years ago, 3 years ago. I think we were doing this podcast, so maybe it wasn't quite, but I can remember saying to you, he did not make a single mistake for the entire season.
He didn't. He operated at that level.
He didn't spin a car.
He didn't
muff a quali session. He didn't hit anybody else. And we saw it at Monza. Lewis made a mistake, and he quite rightly went and apologised for it, and everything else. But I think Max is there at the moment. I think he is at such a level. I think he is certainly as good now as Lewis was then. And then you know you put him in a Red Bull that's functioning like that, and you know it's actually not that surprising, is it? I guess it's I guess there's a bit of luck in there because he hasn't tripped over anybody else. You know, he hasn't had any reliability issues worthy of the mention. So there is clearly an element of luck in there. But even so, absolutely extraordinary. And I know there'll be many more Lewis fans listening to this than Max fans because, you know, this is a podcast which gets listened to predominantly in the UK. But I don't think that, whatever you think of Max, and I probably think more of him than most, I don't think that anyone can just diminish that achievement. It's astonishing.
I do agree. It is an extraordinary achievement. And, you know, certain races, particularly last time out at his home Grand Prix, Zandvoort, I mean, the conditions were horrible. And it would be so easy to trip over yourself in those conditions. Several did. Max didn't.
Yeah.
This point about mistakes, it's no coincidence, really, is it, that a driver, Lewis has done it, Michael did it, Max is doing it at the moment. Driver and car just working together beautifully. And that's when you will see fewer mistakes because they're not having to take chances.
Exactly.
Or drive right on the ragged edge.
And also, they're not in traffic all the time.
Exactly.
They're out there. You know, apart from when they come to lap people at the end of the race, all the sorts of things. Exactly what you're saying, you know, they don't, you know, I mean, Max, once he got past Sainz, he just disappeared, and then he just backed off and cruised and collected. And, yeah, so then everything comes to you. You know, you're not fighting everybody else. You're not on the limit. You're not stressing the machine. So you're less likely to make a mistake. You're less likely to come across somebody else who's going to make a mistake. You're less likely to for your machine to make a mistake. So everything comes to you, doesn't it?
It does. The frustration with all of this is that there isn't a contest really to win the race. We know that yesterday was a prime example. If Max gets past the leader, in this case it was Sainz, wasn't it? We know he's just going to disappear into the distance because he's not being challenged by the other car, the other Red Bull.
Yeah.
It's fine. Dominance from one team is fine when there is at least an intra-team battle going on. Think of the Hamilton-Rosberg years when they were really good.
Yeah.
Even way back to
Senna and Prost.
88, yeah, in the McLaren MP44 year. At least you had two fairly equal drivers.
World-class
going
drivers.
At it. That's right.
World champion drivers, yeah.
Yeah, and I would love to see, in the second Red Bull, a world-class driver, one of the top tier.
Yeah.
You know, that's an Alonso, a Lewis, maybe a Charles.
I'd like to see a young gun. I'd like to see someone, you know, some
Oscar.
Someone like, or even a Lando or someone like that who's really up for the fight. I think it would make Max even better. You know, one of the extraordinary things about Max is he's that good despite not being pushed. And we always, you know, it is human nature to get better at things when you're pushed.
Mm.
You know.
Yeah, that's true. But it's not going to happen. We do think Perez is going to be in the second car next year. And actually, it's the right call from their point of view because he's not putting Max under too much stress
at all. I don't know. I mean, look at Monza. So he couldn't even out-qualify the Ferraris there. And, you know, and for a bit, okay, it came to nothing because, you know, Max has such an advantage. But with the Ferraris both there, you know, sandwiching Max, they were in a position to cause him significant problems. And Perez wasn't there to help. That's why you need a sort of a Bottas type figure, someone who is, you know, quick enough to kind of be there. But then again, you know, but the problem was Bottas, as he always just went off during the course of the race, didn't he? But you need a proper number two. But if you're good enough to be that close to Max, the problem is you're not going to want to be a number two. You'd probably rather be a number one somewhere else, or you probably actually fancy having a pop at Max. So it's a very, very difficult situation to arrange. And but you're right. You're absolutely right.
I think while the Red Bull is as dominant as it is, having a slightly more compliant number two in that team makes sense. But what I will say is next year, if finally Mercedes build a proper car, if finally Ferrari build a really quick, consistent car and operate that team the way it needs to be operated, Might Red Bull be found wanting in the second driver department? Might having, with all due respect to Perez, is a fantastic driver, but he's not a tier one, not for me.
No, and both those teams you mentioned have got better overall driver lineups.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So for now it works for them, but maybe not next year. I don't know.
I think that the secret to winning a motor race is to win any race as slowly as you possibly can. And you know, Max hasn't been pushed, and because Max hasn't been pushed, we haven't seen how fast Max can go. We've seen it in quali, but race, as we know, is a completely different thing. And he never looks on the ragged edge in a race, does he?
No, not in the races, no.
No, so we don't even know how fast Max can make that car go.
That is my concern.
And my concern, yeah, is that they have such a margin. Same people are designing next year's car. There's no real reason to think that it's going to be much different. And the year after that. Yeah. I think it's going to take... 26 is interesting, isn't it? Is it the big rule change in 26, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because then not only is there a big rule change, but then they've got another powertrain. They've got their own powertrain with Ford helping them out with it. And that is a big shake of the dice. I presume that Perez won't still be there then. Maybe he will. I doubt it. That's the real opportunity. And I wonder whether the teams aren't just thinking... Well, we just need to do our very, very best, but actually at the back of the mind's thinking.
Yeah. You know, focus on then.
It's going to be a struggle until then. And 26, I mean, how old will Lewis be in 2026? 42? Yeah, 41.
So, and he's only got a contract to the end of 25,
exactly.
Isn't he?
So
he's still going to be there.
So everything is, you know, and if Ferrari go through, I mean, I know that Charles come out and said some very supportive things of Ferrari, but if they go through another, you know, two... You know, if their drought continues, which I think is now the longest championship-less period that the Scuderia has ever had, I think.
Yeah, amazing. It's coming up to it, I think. Yeah,
It's coming up to it. So if that continues and gets past that mark, is Charles really going to hang around? 26 is, to me, is the interesting year, and I wouldn't be amazed, but I would be surprised if anybody. I'm sure that they'll do better. I'm sure that the Red Bull winning streak will come to an end. But do I think that over a course of whatever it is, a 23-24 race season, one other team is going to be able to mount a sufficient challenge against them for Red Bull not to win the championship? I would be surprised in the next 2 years, but we'll see.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with that. I think that Red Bull is going to continue to be the fastest car out there until the rules change.
And also, don't listen to me, because I'm the bloke who came on this podcast quite a long time ago and said that Red Bull aren't going to win every race this season, because you just can't.
Well, we'll see. Well, it's looking that way,
isn't it? The problem is, with every passing race, the chance of me being proven wrong yet again, you know, increase more. So,
yeah.
We'll see.
So the one point I wanted to make on Max winning 10 in a row is, so we saw Vettel do it again in a Red Bull. But that was in 2013. It was the end of 2013. He won the final 9 races. And the thing is, we knew that was the end of a rule cycle. We knew there were new rules coming for 2014. And the rumour was that the Mercedes power unit was going to be the one to have, that maybe the Renault one, which Red Bull had at that time, wasn't going to be fantastic. So the sort of end was in sight, wasn't it? But for now, we've got stable rules for the next 2 seasons.
Yeah.
Max and that car is far and away the quickest combination at the moment.
Yeah.
It looks likely to be for a while. They could just go on and on and on. Something will happen eventually. Someone will take him out, or maybe he'll make a mistake. Who knows? But so I don't think he's going to win every race over the next couple of years. Of course not. But he could just keep on winning, you know, the vast majority of them, and rattle off all sorts of records. It's going to take a hell of an effort from somebody else to stop that happening.
So what happens, you know, just thinking of that commercially at the moment, you know, the producers of Drive to Survive must be, you know, they must have their heads in their hands at the moment.
Yeah, make this dramatic.
You know, turn this into something which, and again, you know, you've got Lewis sort of saying, oh, it's not healthy for, you know, one team to have a period of such utter domination. Which is a bit rich coming from, you know, from the.
I think he did acknowledge that, but yeah.
Should the organisers step in and go, look, guys, you guys are incredible. This is, you know, the most amazing, you know, team car driver combination that there's ever been. But there's a greater good here. You know, we're all here to put on a show. We're all here because, you know, unless the fans come, unless people buy their Sky subscriptions, unless people, you know, subscribe to Netflix and watch Drive to Vibe, yeah, we're all out of a job. So this is what we're going to do. Should Red Bull's wings be clipped in the interest, you know, should they basically have their success penalised?
Mm. Well, there is a part of me that would like to see it happen because I just want to see proper racing at the very front of the pack again. I want to see variety on the top step of that podium. But it's a sport and you shouldn't meddle like that, in my view.
I completely agree. And also, you know, I think we're in a, it's a slightly unedifying position, but actually it kind of works for me because, you know, if you just take the view that Max has gone, you know, just imagine there are two races and one race has got Max in it, I mean, the Italian Grand Prix, forget Max, was absolutely unbelievable.
It was
one of the most fantastic races. And if you want to see race car drivers, if you want to see, you know, if you're not that interested in watching cars crash, and I hope you're not, but if you just want to see skill, when the speeds are so high, when the downforce levels are so low, you know, watching that battle between Perez and Sainz, and then between Leclerc and Sainz, it was just amazing. And also, you know, further down the field, you know, Alex Albon, I mean, was given what he's in, I think he is driving out of his skin at the moment. And there was so much unbelievable skill. You know, when they, you know, when the cars would come out of the first chicanes and they'd be side by side and be going through the first, through the Curva Grande, you know, absolutely flat out at, you know, 170 miles an hour or whatever they're doing. And they are, but they're probably not inches, they're millimetres away from each other. And they know there's a corner coming up. And you're in this battle of wits. And yet somehow, no one got taken out. I just thought it was, if you love the art and the skill and the beauty of proper driving, it was,
that was it.
Just, all you have to do is forget Max.
I agree. I thought it was a really compelling race. Lewis was so clumsy coming across on Oscar like that, having done exactly what you said around Curva Grande. But I was so glad that he pulled off that move on Albon, just because he got that millimetre perfect, that move into the first chicane. And it just meant that I could walk away from that Grand Prix thinking, not thinking, crikey, has Lewis lost it? Because he got that one just right.
I don't think Lewis hasn't lost it at all. I mean, you know, actually, I think, and I haven't looked at this, my sense is that actually he is, in terms of results and generally speaking, he is ahead of Russell this season.
A long way.
Whereas last year, in my view, he was, and I actually did crunch all the numbers for that over the course of the season. And to me, he was, you know, at best on a par, probably slightly behind. So I can't imagine George is getting any worse. So I think Lewis is still absolutely up there. But, you know, maybe what he's doing is digging into reserves he didn't have to dig into in the past. And maybe that's why, you know, it's not much, is it? But there is, we have seen the odd mistake and the odd penalty creeping in, which would never have happened a few years ago. But then also that comes back to the fact, you know, as we've talked about before, you know, he's in the middle of the pack. He's having to try as hard as he can. And, you know, that's when stuff happens.
We've managed to do more than 15 minutes on F1. We were only going to do a couple. But before we move on, why were the Ferraris so quick? Okay, so I never saw Sainz managing to keep Max behind for the whole Grand Prix. I just didn't think it was going to happen.
No, I agree.
But he out-qualified him.
Yep.
So what's going on there?
Well, I was listening to Martin Brundle on commentary. I think it was Martin. And he said that they brought a... You know, I know Martin was commenting, I just remember whether it was Martin who actually said this particular thing, that they brought, basically they had brought Monza cars, whereas everybody else kind of adapted what they had and just put the, you know, the low downforce wings on, that Ferrari threw the kitchen sink at that race, for entirely understandable reasons. And also, you know, Monza is a very, very different track to almost anywhere else that they race on. It's the lowest downforce track on the surface. You know, interesting things like, you know, one of the massive advantages we know the Red Bull has is its extraordinary ability to deploy DRS. Yeah, well, the less downforce you have, the less DRS you get. And we saw that, didn't we, all the time. You know, even Max was really struggling to get past Sainz. And then poor old Checo, was, you know, he was, you know, they get a lot. It was enough to get you alongside, which in my view is what DRS should do. It shouldn't just allow you a free pass. So, you know, I think that there were a number of reasons. But, okay, so the question is, does this signal a turnaround of Ferrari's fortunes? Are they going to have an amazing... Are they going to be best of the rest of the rest of the season? I doubt it. I think it's Monza. I think it meant more to them. They tried harder there. And the circuit was... I would not necessarily say it was particularly suited to the Ferrari, but I think it was probably quite unsuited to the Red Bull.
Yeah, it's a pity for Ferrari that their home race is such an anomalous track. You can configure your car for that circuit, but it's not going to work anywhere else.
Exactly.
And there is a pressure for them to do so because it's their home Grand Prix. So it's kind of unfortunate for them. But no, I tend to agree with you. I don't think we're going to see them up there for the remainder of the season. But it's just weird what's going on at Aston Martin, isn't it? Did you see Alonso was he qualified 9th or 10th, didn't he? I think 10th. And then just okay, so it sort of came to life towards the end of the race, but no pace in that car. So maybe it's too draggy or something, or that Aston Martin doesn't suit a very low downforce setup. But last time out, he was really racy.
Yeah, I mean they were the second best team at the start of the season, weren't they?
Yeah.
You put them what, fourth now, behind Ferrari and Mercedes.
Mm. Well, certainly after this weekend, yeah.
Yeah.
McLaren up there as well.
Yeah, fifth maybe. Yeah, good point.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what big wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
All right, well, let's leave F1 chat there. And we're going to move on to the Munich Motor Show. I can't remember the last time we spoke about a motor show. It feels like it's sort of the first big one of the year.
There's a reason for that.
I think is it because it is?
Well, yeah. I think there would have been a Chinese one, which those cars tend to be full of sort of concepts and things, stuff like that. So, yeah.
So Munich Motor Show, I mean, there were some fairly interesting reveals, some striking looking concepts as well. The BMW Vision Neue Klasse concept, new class.
That's really interesting. Concept. If you haven't seen it, go and have a look. Because, I mean, in the context of all that everybody has been saying about BMW design over the last few years, this is BMW's, and they're clearly very serious about it, this is a whole new design language for BMW. And can I just say, thank goodness for that.
Yeah, so it's clearly a sort of evolution of that vision, was it Vision D, wasn't it? But they have this new sort of aesthetic, this new style that they're clearly working towards. And we're going to see variations of this in production soon, I'm sure. But it's so welcome, as you say. Some of BMW's recent stuff has been just baffling. But there is a clear, coherent sort of style going on here. You feel like BMW really is working towards a new identity.
Yeah, I think it looks really clean and really interesting.
It's good design, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good design. I could see bits of E30 in there. And it's interesting because I think the first car that we're going to see built to this new design language will be the next 3 Series. I mean, that's going to be eagerly anticipated, isn't it? I mean, that's only a couple of years away. That will be... Then we'll know. Then we'll know. And maybe BMW will finally have acknowledged that, you know, this... you know, this radical, challenging, iconoclastic design that they've had for the last few years hasn't done them all the favours in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting looking car, that. That new BMW. Let's see. Another one I want to talk about is the Cupra Dark Rebel.
Do you struggle to take a car with that name seriously?
Dark Rebel. It's so try hard, isn't it?
For goodness sake.
It's so try hard.
It's just look at me. Please look at me.
It's another concept. But it's a proper two-door sports car GT thing.
Yeah.
I remember years ago when... Not years ago, a few years ago, when Cupra was being sort of reimagined as a standalone mark. And I went to Barcelona to go and talk to the MD about what Cupra stood for. And he told me, he looked me in the eye and he said, Cupra is born from racing. We are a racing mark and we build sporting cars. And I was like, great, so you're going to build a sports car at some point? And he sort of dodged the question. And then I just watched over the years. Their first car was the Cupra Ateca, big SUV. And then followed that up with variations on the performance SUV theme. And I just thought, I think this is totally cynical. I just do not understand how you can claim this is a racing mark and then just build SUV after SUV. I get it. They sell, people buy them.
Yeah.
But come on, where's the credibility? And this is the first sort of bespoke sporting car that they've hinted at.
Yeah.
It is a concept.
And
but
they've gone and called Dark Rebel.
Dark Rebel.
do you think I could pull that off?
Andrew Dark Rebel Frankel.
No, nor me. But it does. Cupra. It is. It certainly is. Visually interesting.
Yeah, it's quite exciting.
And if anything were to come of it, it would be great. But have they said they're going to build it or anything like it?
No. They haven't said. It's a concept. But please, Cupra, build something that driving enthusiasts...
Build something interesting.
...might get excited about.
Even if you don't sell many of them, it'll build your brand for you. People will give you... It'll give you credibility.
The Halo thing has worked for decades. Give it a go. But their next car is going to be the Cupra Tavascan, which is related to the Volkswagen ID2.
Oh,
so,
okay.
There you go. Right. That's not the one that we're going to get worked up about, is it?
No. There is an ID we should be getting worked out of that show, though, isn't there?
Yeah, I'm doing this in alphabetical order, so that comes at the end.
Oh, okay.
But for now, Mercedes-Benz CLA concept. Again, a bit like the BMW. It's an electric four-door saloon concept thing. Maybe it's not a saloon, but you know what I mean. And there's a very clear design language to it. You know, there's a clear identity. So great. I mean, just go and build something that actually looks like it, please, Mercedes. And maybe people will buy them in their droves. It's an interesting, striking looking car.
Yeah.
But let's get these things into showrooms, onto the road, rather than just the motor show stands.
Yeah. I mean, when people... I'm not talking about Mercedes really, but you know, if a car manufacturer goes to a big motor show, and really all they've got to show that's new is a new concept car, my inner cynic always says the same thing: haven't got anything else, can't allow all the rivals to steal all the oxygen. Got to have something. Mm. Let's do a concept. Now I'm not saying
just to get some column inches.
I'm not saying that is the case with Mercedes or with BMW. Maybe these things will go into production. I'm sure the BMW will. Looking very like that very soon. I really, really hope so. Because, yeah, otherwise, you know, we know that why they're there.
New Mini Cooper.
Looks
good. Cooper Electric, Cooper S. Yeah.
Yeah. All electric.
It's clearly an evolution of the Mini design as we've come to know it since, what was it, 99, wasn't it?
Yeah, 99. It looks the same, but it looks good. And it's it's all electric. You won't be able to buy a combustion Mini anymore.
Yeah,
Cooper certainly.
Yeah, so that means the Cooper SE, which is the new Cooper S, will have 215 horsepower, 0-60 in 6.7 apparently, 54 kilowatt hour battery, 250 miles of range. So that's an interesting one. I'm looking forward to having a go in that and seeing if Because Minis are always, you know, these BMW-era Minis have been fun to drive.
Yeah.
Fun little cars.
And even the... I had an electric Mini in quite recently, only because I'd never driven one. And they said, do you want to? I went, yeah. I really enjoyed driving it. And I really enjoyed driving it, I'm afraid, for one reason, one of it is, it's got a tiny battery in it, so it doesn't weigh anything. So you can go hooning around at the thing. And if you don't mind having to charge it every 10 minutes, it's great.
Right. Last one then, the one that you hinted at a while ago. Yeah, Volkswagen ID GTI. So they're calling it a concept, but this is based on the ID2, so smaller than the ID3. Little hatchback. It's not that little though, is it? But it's the new GTI. This is the future of Volkswagen's GTI model line.
Yeah.
Looks good, I think.
I thought it looked good. Yeah.
Striking looking thing. I mean, it is a concept, so it's going to look
a bit more dramatic than a road car. Some other concepts, I think this one really will happen, albeit in 2-3 years' time. But, I mean, goodness me. I mean, what could be more important for Volkswagen credibility other than to get that right?
Mm. Yeah, GTI is such an important model name, which
Volkswagen's entire future is built upon, and it's their most, you know, vaunted, fated, coveted nameplate they've attached to it. It's got to be right.
Yeah, it can't just be, you know, potent. It can't just have a load of power and feel brisk. It needs to be genuinely fun to drive.
It's got to be a bloody driver's car.
Yeah, it has.
Yeah.
And it can't have a massive battery, as you suggested, with the Mini, because it's just going to weigh too much if it does.
Mm.
They need to make that thing really fun to drive. It needs to have character.
Can you imagine the arguments that must go on at the moment between marketing people and engineers? And engineers going, no, 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 you can't have a battery that side because it'll be terrible to drive. And marketing people, well, yeah, fine. I take your point, but unless it does have a battery that side, we're not going to be able to sell it.
And if you're the CEO having to arbitrate here.
Yeah.
It's tough, isn't it?
It's really, really tough. We always used to talk about the arguments used to go on between engineers and designers. But I think they're going on between engineers and marketing people now. And, of course, you know, there's no right answer.
No. Of course, yeah, I mean, we clearly lean towards make it a fun driver's car, don't we? Because enthusiasts. But we're not responsible for
But if people look at that and go,
production numbers,
it's only got a practical range of 180 miles. People aren't going to buy it. Well, you know, the best car in the world, you know, very clever, but if it doesn't sell, it's failed fairly fundamentally, hasn't it? So, yes, don't envy.
It doesn't matter if we give it 10
those.
Out of 10.
No.
Yeah. Tough one. Good. Well, that's Munich Motor Show. So, there are some interesting... They're all electric, aren't they? All the cars we've spoken about there, I think. But some interesting stuff on its way, so bring it on. Right, Fast Estates. That's what we're really talking.
Fast Estates. We're
two-thirds of the way through this episode, and we're only just getting onto the main topic.
Yeah.
But Fast Estates. Now, we want to talk about these because you've got one in at the moment.
Yeah, I've got a really fast one in at the moment.
I saw on your Instagram that you're really quite impressed with the Audi RS6 performance.
Yeah, only because I just wasn't expecting to be.
What is the performance? Because the RS6 has been around for good couple of years now, a few years.
Yeah, a few years. So the performance
it's
got bigger turbos.
More power.
It's got, yeah, funnily enough, I think it's 640 horsepower.
That'll do.
And it's got, yeah, you know, higher level of specification and so on and so forth. And I know that, you know, there are lots of people who absolutely adore these things, you know, RS6s and that sort of thing. I've just always been a bit lukewarm about them. Some I've liked more than others, but they've never, to me, had the chassis to go with the performance that they provide.
Yeah.
I always just find that frustrating.
Mm.
This one does. Yeah, and this hasn't even got there because there's an option. You can option in coils instead of air and carbons instead of steel discs. And it hasn't even got that option on it. But obviously it's going to be ridiculously fast. But it is just so beautifully resolved. I just really, really, I mean, I've been up in the mountains with it. And it's never going to be, you know, an agile car. I think it weighs 2.1 tons. But it is so, I think deft is the word. It rides really nicely. You know, who'd have thought? It's balanced. It's... Clearly, it's been developed by people who understand what a fine driving car is and that it's not all just about more and more power. It's a one, apart from the hideous fuel consumption, it does like a, if you're just driving it normally, without being an idiot, it does about 23 to the gallon. If you try as hard as you possibly can, you might see 30. But if you drive it at all, you know, in the manner to which it's designed to be driven, it's kind of like, you know, 16, 17. That aside, I just sat here thinking, I just love this. I would just absolutely love, because it's all about the chassis. I mean, it's called performance and it's 640 horsepower, so that goes and grabs all the headlines. It's actually not what the car's about at all. It's the fact that it has been refined to a point where suddenly and finally and at last, its chassis is as good as the powertrain that goes with it. And I, that's the first time in one of those sorts of cars, I'm not talking about R8s or things like that, but I've known that happen in an Audi, so bravo. And I just really, really hope it is, you know, a change of philosophy and a sign of the direction in which Audi is going to continue to go with those cars.
Yeah, let's hope so. Engineers these days, at the likes of Audi clearly, and certainly BMW M, they're getting so good at making heavy cars both ride and handle well.
Yeah.
They're getting so damn good at it. It used to be that we would look at a spec sheet and go, well, it's 2.1 tonnes, it's just not going to be fun to drive.
Yeah.
But they're starting to really get a handle on the weight of these cars. It's a different sort of...
And I'd never say for, you know, I'd never say, oh, you know, it feels like it's a 1,500 kilo car, because it doesn't. It feels like a 2.1 ton car. But, and it's not a hoot to drive. You're not, you know, sliding it around. It's not, you know, like a Caterham. It's a different sort of fun. It's a kind of like a, it's an inner smile. It's a deep satisfaction. It's rather than a belly laugh. And, you know, you just really admire what they've done with it and the way that they've controlled its mass so well. You're never not aware of that mass, but you're also very aware of the fact that it's, you know, it's not getting in the way.
Yes.
Like you would expect it to.
Yeah, that it's that frustration factor.
Yeah.
It's gone. You're no longer thinking, goodness me, this thing's big and heavy and corpulent and floaty and wallowy.
Exactly, because it isn't any of those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, best fast estates then.
Yeah.
First of all, just sort of more broadly, why do we like these cars? It is the sort
work.
Of duality, the breadth of ability.
They
isn't
work.
It? But I wonder, how often do people actually use the estate part of a performance estate? I mean, some do, clearly.
In
the back.
I think lots do.
Yeah,
because I don't think they're particularly image cars. Something like an RS6 might be. But I think, you know, a lot of the cars that, you know, that we've really enjoyed as estate cars, you know, the BMW M340i Touring that I've got parked outside here at the moment. You know, I don't think that people buy that as a touring rather than a saloon because they think, oh, that's going to make me look cool. I think they buy it as a touring because they need a bit of extra space, or they might like the idea of having a bit of extra space, or they can imagine, you know, some kind of use scenario where it's going to be handy. So I think, and I guess that's another thing I like about them, is that I think they do get used for the purpose for which they were designed. They work. That's why I love them.
Yeah, you're right, actually. That is a good point. They do work, and you do use them for the purpose for which they are designed. Whereas plenty of other types of car, they're designed for this particular purpose, and you never go anywhere near that,
exactly,
that area of capability.
Yeah.
You know, off-roaders, all sorts of other cars. And so you're actually using them for the thing that they're not primarily designed for, and so they're frustrating. Whereas, yeah, maybe these, that doesn't apply to. So Audi have been producing cars like this for a very long time. I liked the current RS6. I haven't tried the performance. I liked the previous RS6, but only to a point.
Exactly.
Where it's a nice thing to be in. They can be surprisingly comfy. They are quick. They look good. But you're never going to get up early and go for a spirited drive in it. But it sounds like this new performance maybe puts that right a little bit.
Yeah, the only other sort of fast Audi estate that I would say has made me feel that warm about it is the last, I can't remember what the code name is, but the last of the V8 RS4 estates.
So they did the B7, which was had the manual gearbox, option of a manual gearbox,
yeah.
And then the B8 had was paddle shift only. And I liked the B7. The B8, I was a little bit cool on.
Maybe it's the B7 I'm thinking about.
Yeah, the B7 was that one with the big wide arches.
Yeah, exactly. That's the one.
Yeah, yeah. That was a great car, and I drove one a few years ago. Audi have got one on their heritage fleet, and that it is a lovely car, but it is. I think maybe because the engine's so sweet, it's got a nice manual transmission. The chassis is pretty good.
Yeah, but it's not. It's not. It's all right, isn't it?
It's to a point.
But it's nothing like as good as the engine.
What about the Jaguars? Because there have been the Jaguar XFR and the XFRS. You can have a, what do they call it, sport brake or sport back or something. But they've got that mega powerful, super responsive, that supercharged V8 that JLR have used for years in all sorts of vehicles. Do you like those things? They've always been massively traction limited, haven't they? Whenever you put your foot down in those things, they just...
No, I've got a picture of myself in one of them, and there's just, you know, and because they didn't have diffs in them, did they? So there was just,
more smoke one.
Yeah, exactly. I did. I like the way they looked. Surprise, surprise, Ian Callum was doing the styling. I think that they looked terrific. But to me, if I was going to get an estate like that, I'd just get an E-Class, you know.
That's
the thing, you know. Because the E-Class was such a great estate. It had so much more space in its boot. People forget this about this, you know. Audis and BMWs, fine. But if you actually want a car that would carry stuff... among the premium German brands, you needed an E-Class. And that, I can't remember what the W, whatever it was, the one with the nutty 6.2 AMG in it. That was fabulous.
That is a great car. That is a fantastic car.
So if I was going to get that kind of car, I'd just get the Benz.
That's what you'd have.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I remember doing the launch in Portimao. And actually, they launched the saloon first, so we drove that one rather than the estate, but it's the same car underneath. And I just, three of us just howling nose to tail around Portimao, howling around in the E63. It was just a fantastic car.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the first big, heavy cars that I drove that I thought, blimey, they've figured this out. They've got this sussed.
Yeah.
This really is spectacular. So that is a great car. But let's rewind, let's scroll it back a little bit. Some of the older stuff.
There's only one old estate car that's worth having, and funnily enough, it's actually not that great to drive. Citroën DS19 Safari.
Oh my god, I'm not sure anyone saw that coming.
I was somewhere not that long ago, and Harris turned up in a DS19 Safari. And we all piled into it, and we all toddled off to the pub, hooting with laughter. I think Tuthill had it. I can't remember why Chris was in it, but anyway, he just in his own inimitable way just turned up in something completely unexpected, and I just loved it because it's a beautiful car, but again, it just knows what it thought. It was so comfortable, it was so spacious, it was in its own way. In its own rather sort of slow, plodding, roly, wallowy kind of way, it was a delight to drive. That's what I mean. You probably weren't thinking about going quite. You probably weren't thinking about going back to the 1950s. You were thinking about sort of Volvo T5Rs and that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Early 90s or something.
Yeah, yeah. So let's do that too.
But you've said Volvo T5R. Yeah. People love those.
Yeah,
partly because TWR took them racing, and even now those photographs of those Volvo estate cars, British touring cars racing, look extraordinary.
Yeah.
But were the road cars actually good?
Ooh. I have to be honest here, they just weren't.
They just weren't.
I mean, they've got this wonderful reputation. I never liked them when they were new. And again, I suspect mine is a minority view. But what just bugged the hell out of me, they came with those incredibly low profile P0 tyres, and they just didn't ride.
It
was incompetent. They just crashed and banged along, and they took so much of the enjoyment out of driving. I knew that, and if the result of that was that they handled unbelievably well, Well, you know, you could make a case for it. But they didn't. They handled it. They were all right. But they were still, you know, front drive Volvos with massively nose heavy 5-cylinder engines parked under their bonnets. No, I mean, they looked fantastic and they sounded great and people went racing in them. So they were fantastic image builders. And I completely get why they are sort of slightly cultish cars today. They also, you know, given that this is a Volvo, they weren't very good estate cars. There wasn't much room in the back. I mean, you know, we think, you know, when I started doing this business, it was back in the day of, you know, 740 and then 940 Volvos. These were things that you could, you know, put your house in the back of. Well, then the 850 came along and, you know, they decided they took an act, and commercially it was completely the right decision to make, that Volvos would stop being tanks and they'd start being stylish and they would become, and I think this is probably all Peter Horbury's doing, and they were great to look at and it transformed Volvo's image. And you know, had it not done that, then, you know, I think the whole future of Volvo would have been very different and nothing like as good. But, you know, the question was the T5R a great car to drive? Absolutely not. Really nice engine and a great looking car, but that was it.
Crystal clear. Crystal clear. Are there any others that spring to mind?
I found one for you.
Go on, give us one more.
And you're going to have to be honest with me and tell you whether you knew this car even exists. Okay,
go on.
This is your ultimate car. This is the Dan Prosser car to end all Dan Prosser cars.
What on earth are you talking about?
Evo 9 Estate.
Ah, yes. Yes, so the 9. I definitely knew that they did an estate. So the 7, 8, 9 were evolutions of one another, weren't they? I knew that car existed. Was it?
I mean, that's just your car, isn't it? I mean, they made them in tiny quantities. I'm not even sure whether any came over here. There was an Evo 9 wagon. I never drove one, don't even know whether it was based on, not sure it was any good or not, but I just saw that and I just thought of you.
So we are buying an estate car at the moment.
Yeah. But it's not an Evo 9?
It's not, but maybe I need to suggest it to my other half and just say, I've had an idea. Bear with me.
E61 M5, perhaps?
God, I wish. No, sadly, this has to be the sensible family car, so it's not going to be that exciting.
My brother's got a Golf R estate, and he absolutely swears by it.
Yeah, I did wonder about
your
that.
Your generation of Golf, so 7.5 R estate.
Yeah.
Cracking car.
It was on my list, because it's longer in the... is it longer in the wheelbase? So it has more rear seat space, I think, than a hatch. Which is actually what's important to us at the moment.
Yeah.
Because we've got baby seats and they take up a lot of room. But, it's actually going to be my partner's car. So, sadly, well, she will be paying for it and she gets to decide what it is.
No.
So, I think it's going to be a 3 Series, which I'd be very happy with, actually.
320D estate.
320i, like I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, 320i. Facelift one, so...
Brilliant.
Like the one you've got at the moment.
Yeah.
So just tell us briefly about your M340i, because it does go soon, doesn't it? I mean, you...
Yeah, I'm not going to bang on about it, because it's got, as you know, it's got one more specific job to do, which we'll be talking about, I guess, in a few weeks' time. Yeah, it goes in a month, which I shall be very upset about. It's close to the perfect daily. In fact, yeah, I think probably in retrospect, the only thing I'd change about it is I'd turn the I into a D. Because what's the I buying you? A bit more performance? Well, frankly, I'd rather not have the fuel bills and I'd prefer to have the range. Other than that, it just works. It's one of those cars which... It's just not bad at anything. It's a really annoying car because it's really quite hard to criticise. And even something like an M3 Touring is a much easier car to criticise. And I've never sat there thinking, oh God, I wish it had another 100 horsepower, or it went round a corner even quicker than it does. To me, in terms of, you know, what I want a car to do in terms of driving dynamics, it's more than good enough. It's got more than enough room in it to, yeah, it's just the perfect all-rounder. I think I've said before, and probably on this podcast, certainly in print, that I think it's the best BMW on sale at the moment. I think it's one of the best BMWs of recent years. I think it is absolutely outstanding. I really do.
And before it goes, we are putting it to the test, aren't we? Let's not give it away, but we've devised a test for that car. to see exactly how good it is. And there will be a story coming to the Intercooler app and website in the next few weeks. Well, unless you want to give us any other estates, we'll move on.
Well, can I just float the... I think it's probably a really bad idea. But just float... the ultimate sort of stealth estate. Passat W8.
Yeah. Yes, there is something about that.
Yeah.
There really is.
Yeah.
When you hear one go by, which doesn't happen very often, you just think, what was that?
Not very
How
often,
many are
because
there?
They only sold 246 Passat with W8 engines, of which not very many were estates. They actually did. There are 20. They sold 20 manual Passat estates in the UK. How many of those do you think survive?
Ugh.
20
well,
manual
there is
W8.
A website, isn't there?
Is there?
Yeah, how many left? I don't know if it'll tell you about manuals, but...
It'll tell you how many Passat W8s are around. Yeah. It might even tell you how many Passat W8 estates are left. I'm going, not many.
Not many.
It wasn't a great car. The idea just amuses me.
Okay, that's a shame. So I've written a piece about estate cars, but very intentionally not performance estate cars. So that'll be going live fairly soon. I grew up with estate cars in my family as a kid. We had a series of fairly nasty, ratty...
Go on, what were they?
So my dad had an Austin Montego.
what engine?
Terrible car. Oh, God knows. No, I was a young kid, tiny kid when we had it. But it had the seats in the back.
Oh, hang on.
So I loved
We've forgotten one.
Go on.
The
Montego
ZTT.
GTI.
No, the ZTT. The MG ZTT estate with the Mustang 260 horsepower Mustang. How could we have forgotten that?
Rear wheel drive. Did they do a Rover 75 estate version as well? Because you could get the V8 in the 75.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there was a Rover 75 V8. Was there a Rover 75 V8 estate? I should know that. I'm appalled I don't know that. There was definitely a ZT estate because they called it the ZTT.
Yeah. Cool car.
Yeah. Ridiculous
so
car.
My dad never had a ZTT, obviously. He did have a... I can't work out if it would have been a Mark III or a Mark IV Escort estate. Orange.
Oh.
Dreadful car.
Yeah.
Had it very briefly, I think.
Yeah.
Because it probably died.
Yeah.
And then later on, he upgraded to a Honda Accord Aero Deck.
Oh, not bad.
I mean, it's an old, tired car by the time he got it.
Yeah.
It cost him a couple of grand. But that was a nice car.
Yeah.
Leather seats and electric whatevers. And yeah, it wasn't terrible like the previous cars. So we had this whole string of proper functional, very sort of uninteresting estate cars growing up. And so I've always had a bit of a soft spot for them. Because, you know, for what you were saying earlier, you use them, you put them to the use for which they were designed. You sling all sorts of stuff in the back. And the reason I'm writing this now is partly because we are buying one for ourselves, so it's sort of front of mind for me at the moment. But the estate car, I don't know how long it's going to live for, really. You know, there are some new ones coming. We think the big German manufacturers will keep producing them, but the Mondeo estate is gone because the Mondeo is gone. The Insignia estate is gone because the Insignia is gone. Volvo, as we know, they announced last month, they're not going to sell estate cars, or for saloons for that matter, in the UK anymore. I explore the reasons why in the story, but the estate car is potentially a dying breed.
Oh, hang on. There's a thing called a coelacanth. You may not know
what?
A coelacanth. It was an ancient... What is it? Is it a reptile? I don't know what it was. Anyway, it was presumed to be extinct for 35 million years until someone found one.
Really?
Yeah.
Where'd they find it?
Don't know. But they found it, and it's back. Okay, so
there we go.
So another great Frankel prediction, and I hope still to be alive when it comes true, is that the estate is not finished. It may be down, but it's not out. Because ultimately, surely, the world is going to have to revert to what works. And that's the thing. Estates do work because they're not high, and they're not heavy, and they're not profligate. And they do the job. Ultimately... You know, it comes down to fitness of purpose. It comes down to product. And it's just a really bloody good concept. And I know that you know, all the market pressures, and, you know, we're not going to get into the whole SUV debate again here now, but, you know, I understand why things are the way they are at the moment. But, you know, I don't see them staying that way forever. And when it changes, the estate, the trusty, honest, noble estate car will rise again, phoenix-like from the ashes. And I hope I'm around to see it.
Let's see. Let's see. Right. Let's just end this this week's episode with a listener question. And this is a good old-fashioned, which car should I buy kind of question.
Okay.
And he even gives us a handful of cars to choose from.
Goodness for that. These
are so difficult because you don't know what a person's sort of priorities or preferences are in a car.
Yeah.
So all we can do is just say, I like that one, have that one.
Usually, when people ask me, I would say almost invariably, actually, when people ask me what car they should buy, what they actually mean is, I've already decided what car I'm going to buy, and I want you to tell me I'm right.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes? Yes.
Well, I hope Hans Vigen, good name, you haven't already decided. Maybe you have. But, I hate when people ask me which car I should buy, because I find it so hard to know which of the options they come up with, or I come up with, they're going to enjoy most. It's a guessing game. But anyway, Hans lives in Norway. He's just sold his GR Yaris after 2 years and is looking for something fun. He says, four-wheel drive for snow and ice would be nice, but it's not a must-have.
Yeah. It's funny enough, up there, if you go up there, you'd be amazed at how many cars don't have four-wheel drive.
Yeah, because you have winter tyres.
Yes, winter tyres. And they bimble about with front-wheel drive cars and winter tyres, and they're absolutely fine. Anyway, sorry, move on.
You're fine. So, a couple of 911s. 991-1-4S.
Okay.
991-2-2S.
Well, that's not very difficult to decide. Yeah. That's not a difficult decision to make.
So, first, Cayman GT4.
Yeah, okay.
In Norway.
Yeah.
Jaguar F-Type R, all-wheel drive. M2 Comp or CS. Or an R8. He says a V8 manual is impossible to find.
I mean, as you say, it just depends on what he wants it for. If it's if it's to use a lot, it's the Gen 2 Carrera 2S. If it's more recreational, it's the GT4. If, you know, you're talking about completely different sums of money too, aren't you? You know, I love an M2 comp. I really do. I don't know. It's one of those.
I quite like the idea of an F-Type R all-wheel drive on winters in Norway. That's quite sort of iconoclastic. You're not going to bump into another one.
No, well, that's true. That's true. If I had that, I think I'd be pleased with myself for having decided to do it. And once I'd done it, I'd just think, why didn't I just get a 911?
Yeah. So there you go, Hans. We haven't really given you much of an answer there, but maybe it's something to think about. But anyway, thank you for your question. Remember to keep sending your questions across, and we'll carry on ending the podcast by answering them. Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.